From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Good afternoon. I hope you all had the opportunity to pay your respects to the brave men and women who have given their lives for our freedom yesterday on Memorial Day.
That was the White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer returning to his regular press briefings this Tuesday after last week's trip abroad by President Trump.
I want to begin by recapping the incredible historic trip that the President and the First Lady have just concluded, because it truly was an extraordinary week for America and our people.
For more on that, we spoke with Dmitry Babich, senior editor at Russia's news agency, Sputnik. So, Dmitry, it's been quite a week.
I agree, because there was the summit of NATO. There was the visit by Trump to Saudi Arabia, where he signed all these defense contracts. There was the G7 summit. And it's interesting that the G7 summit was somehow the least interesting of all of these events, probably because people are starting to understand how irrelevant G7 is. How can you decide the fates of the world without China, without Russia, without Brazil, without India? So when these people imagine themselves as masters of the universe, it just tells you that they are stuck in the 70s in their worldview.
Yeah, I mean, to drive that point home, you had the meeting of Wang Yi, first with President Putin and then with the Foreign Minister Lavrov in Moscow, and they announced, first and foremost, our relations are better than at any time in our history, and they will only continue to get better, no backsliding. And they were talking about deepening economic ties, which you're seeing. You saw the Belt and Road meeting a week or two prior. This whole rising Eurasian entity is happening in front of everyone, whether they like it or recognize it in the media here or not.
Well, it's true, and it's a true miracle, because the Russian elite, since Russia's independence from the defunct Soviet Union in 1991, the Russian elite was more geared to the West. The European Union and the United States, they were the countries of our dreams, certainly not India, not the rising China. Maybe Japan had a much more positive image than China. And somehow now, simply because the West is behaving so inadequately, the Eurasian cooperation, which seemed a pipe dream just 5 years ago, 6 years ago, people would laugh at you for talking about a new kind of economic entity that would comprise both Russia and China. You know, this economic cooperation is becoming a reality, worth hundreds of billions of dollars every year.
Yeah, I mean, one way that you could look at the performance, quote-unquote, of the West would be to compare what's happened since 1991 in Japan with what's happened in China. Japan was the rising star then. It was the center of the universe. They had been buying, for example, Rockefeller Center in New York City and all of that. And then it went into the longest, I don't know, stagflation period, maybe in any of any quote-unquote Western, odd for an Asian country, but Western economy in history. Meanwhile, China has grown faster and larger than any economic entity in the history of humanity.
Well, that's true. Japan has been a sort of a disappointment during the last 25 years. The reason why I was interested in the NATO summit, it was just how far can these people go in being so shameless? I mean, Donald Tusk, the head of the European Council, he called Trump, the president of the United States, a security threat to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
In the old times, people would have a duel because of such an insult. And they meet pretending to be friends, and Trump pretends not to notice anything, and they almost embrace each other, and as if nothing had happened. And the problem is that Tusk was not alone. There was a whole summit of the EU devoted to Trump's presumed alliance with Russia and the threats that would stem from such an alliance. So it was not just Mr. Tusk, it was the whole European establishment that was very anti-Trump, that was hysteric about the defeat of Hillary Clinton at the elections. And now they pretend that nothing has happened. And I think such things are dangerous because words should matter. If you said something and you're an official person, this is all on record. So if you say something, your words should have some weight. If you insult someone and the next day you behave as if nothing happened, then it is not like a Christian ability to forgive. It's a very unstable, dangerous situation. Duels and the whole concept of honor in Europe, it was not just a feudal prejudice, aimed at fostering your ambition. It was about security. Words should mean something. If you say a word, you should be held responsible for it. So what we see right now is total irresponsibility with words. So my two selected moments of the last week, first it was this Trump-Tusk meeting. You might think that they were friends when they met.
Right.
And second, it was Obama's speech in Baden-Baden, where Obama was given a prize of the German media, Medienpreise in German. And Obama gave there a speech on the need to fight propaganda. So, to hear Mr. Obama teaching journalists how they should avoid propaganda in their articles after last year's electoral campaign, when basically they called one of the candidates, the American media inspired by Obama and supported by Obama. They called one of the candidates, let me just quote it, a jerk, a deadbeat, someone who has no manners, vulgarity unbound. So for Mr. Obama to teach avoidant propaganda, that is a travesty. That was actually a comedy. I think if we had a modern Molière, he would have written a whole comedy about that prize and that Obama speech.
Yeah, I mean, that's another interesting aspect, by the way, of what was displayed by the European elite this past week, was that they had Obama there immediately before Trump's first visit to upstage, and he was lecturing, sitting with Angela Merkel, of all people, lecturing the world on democracy as well, which is a pretty interesting exercise indeed.
Well, yes, bearing in mind that it was Angela Merkel who was all politeness with Viktor Yanukovych in November 2013 during the Vilnius summit, only to wish his destruction and basically death in February 2014.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone understood that when the so-called peaceful protesters who accidentally killed 23 policemen, when they did not fulfill the agreement between Yanukovych and the opposition, guaranteed among other countries by Germany, by the German foreign minister, obviously Yanukovych fled for his life, because when these so-called peaceful protesters rushed through the police lines and occupied the Rada, beating some of the deputies, it was clear that the deputies would be just beaten. He would be killed. So he fled. And then Mrs. Merkel pretended that she didn't know why he fled in the middle of the night, as John Kerry put it two or three days later.
Yeah, right.
Mrs. Merkel's responsibility for the tragedy in Donbas is absolutely obvious, and it is huge. She did not guarantee the agreement between Yanukovych and the opposition, so the political confrontation developed into a civil war. She basically created the new dividing lines in Europe, the new confrontation in Europe, by treating Greece as a colony, as a country that simply should not have its own independent policy, that should not decide how its budget could be spent, simply because these people owed money to German banks. So her record on peace is dismal, to say the least, you know. And she is now teaching people, together with former President Obama, she is teaching people in Berlin how they should see peace. And let me remind you that she was doing it with Obama 2 or 3 hours before meeting Donald Trump in Brussels.
Right.
Donald Trump, whom she couldn't believe to have won the election. You remember when he won the election, yeah, for several days, there was absolutely almost no comment from Mrs. Merkel, because she simply could not believe that the globalist elite could allow something like that to happen. She had all her papers prepared for Clinton.
Yeah.
Well, and these people are teaching us democracy, peace, and other such things. That was just the most shameful moment of this week. I think it was much worse than Trump's behavior with the Montenegrin prime minister, whom Trump just shoved aside in order to be photographed in front of all the others. So Trump is not good. I mean, this is the conflict of our century. When people talk about Trump's possible impeachment, they keep arguing whether he is good or bad. The problem is not whether Trump is good or bad. The problem is that the charges on which they try to remove him or try to damage him, these charges are absolutely faked up. You know, like Trump passing secrets to the Russian foreign minister, Trump not liking peace and freedom while Obama likes them. So if you can remove a popularly elected president on completely faked up charges, then you can remove anyone. Because this is the highest position in the Western world, the president of the United States. That was the decision of the American voters, not of Russian voters, not of German voters, not a decision of the people from the third world, whom the globalists absolutely, absolutely despise. It was the decision of the American voters. So if they can overturn that decision, then there are no hurdles for them. Only a war can stop them.
Right. You know, in terms of instructing people on the questions of democracy and peace, Trump kind of threw a grenade, and has since the beginning of his musings on NATO, into the room by suggesting, or actually now demanding, that the members of NATO pay up the 2% of their GDP that they're required to pay for their own defense. More than 2/3 of them do not. And the political environment, of course, in which this takes place is one of austerity for most of the countries, for the majority of people inside the EU, adding to that burden by upping their share of their own defense means intensifying austerity. And there's already been for decades a pretty strong anti-war movement in Europe, and this will only exacerbate that. So when Trump says, you know, pay your own freight, he's basically saying do something that's going to put people in the streets demanding peace.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the problem with this 2% rule is that it is basically unfair because, Italy, for example, had absolutely no interest in occupying Iraq. Spain had absolutely no interest in supporting Kosovo against Yugoslavia because Spain has its own separatist provinces, right?
Right.
So these countries simply do not want to pay so as much as the United States does, percentage-wise, simply because they don't have such ambitions. You know, it's like you have a company, you have a concern. You know, people are making investments, and there are different kinds of investments there. There are some who want to drill oil wells and who want to get huge amounts, and there are some who simply want, you know, to keep their home safe and to do their little business. So it is basically unfair to require smaller NATO members with no imperial ambitions to carry the same financial burden as the aggressors, as the United States or the UK or France. It was France that attacked Libya in 2011.
Right.
The French bombers bombed Libya because presumably they wanted to save, the Libyan opposition from Gaddafi's claws. That was the sphere of influence of France. France obviously hoped that they would call the shots in Libya after Gaddafi is removed.
And this is right after France had removed the president of Cote d'Ivoire at gunpoint from the presidential palace, exactly. Gbagbo.
And that passed almost unnoticed by other European countries because they're used to the situation when, in the countries like Mali or Cote d'Ivoire, it's France who calls the shots since the 19th century. But I don't know, some country like Denmark or like Holland, they had no interest in Libya and in North Africa in general. So the question is, why should these countries carry the same financial burden? And Trump pretends not to notice it. He, as usual, is very blunt. I think it is sometimes even good that he's so blunt because thanks to his stupidity, he blurts out something that the other ones were too ashamed to say. He just wants the other ones to participate in the imperial projects of the United States. He wants the people in the countries like Denmark or Lithuania to pay for, say, a possible operation against North Korea. That is his position. And he's pretty rude on that. I mean, his words about the bad Germans, everyone understands it was not a racial remark. It was a remark from someone who just doesn't want to give up his portion of the market. The Germans were bad, according to Mr. Trump, simply because they exported cars to the United States.
Right.
If, for example, President Putin had called Microsoft or other American giants bad for basically being monopolists on the market of software in many countries, including Russia, that would be seen as an insult to their free trade, as isolationism, all these things. But when Trump is basically pursuing isolationism, that is kind of accepted, at least by the mainstream press in Europe, for example.
So, and that's been one of the one of the things all along is Trump blurting out these truths that just are never part of the narrative otherwise. He is the classic bull in a china shop. And when you're talking about some of the discrete distinctions within NATO, you look at a country like Hungary or, some of the places where, the product of the war on Syria is millions of refugees. They've been driven out by NATO bombing and, these crazy people that are backed by the U.S. and U.K. and others are driven out of Syria. And many of them are in Europe. And it's like, okay, well, we want your 2%. Plus, here's 800,000 people you have to feed, clothe, and house. And so the United States doesn't have that kind of fallout from it, just Europe.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that indeed the European Union, if you look at their policy, they're not much better than the United States, and in some spheres they're even worse. Mm-hmm. Let me remind you about the attitude to the Russian problem. When Trump said during his campaign that he wanted to improve the reaction of the European Union when he won the election. Oh, how awful that was their reaction. He is going to make the worst friends with Russia again. Terrible. That is a threat to European security. He is Putin's stooge. He's extremely dangerous. And they didn't come down until Trump basically bombed Syria by Tomahawk missiles. Until then, they were very concerned. So, in a way, the European Union is worse than the United States because the United States is, after all, a country which is very ideologized, which is ruled by the globalist elite. But the United States may one day wake up to its own national interests and say no to something like the new Iraqi invasion, from which the United States suffered more, probably more than anyone else except Iraq. I mean, there were 4,000 American servicemen killed during that campaign.
That's right.
Not to count all the maimed, all the wounded, all the sickos who later committed crimes in the United States. And so the United States is a country, after all. And the European Union is an ideological project, which sometimes is absolutely indifferent to the economic interests of its members. The so-called South Stream from Russia was actually a very good project for the EU as a whole, and especially for its poorer southern members. Greece and Italy, they are problematic countries inside the EU. They have huge debts. How can they pay these debts? By reviving their industry. Cheap Russian energy would help them to revive their industry.
Right.
So what was the reaction from the European Union? They did everything in their power to stop the South Stream, to make it an impossibility. Why? Because ideologically, they were more interested in not allowing Russia to have some new revenues. And they were even more interested in ruining Russia than in making their own members prosperous. That's the problem.
Yeah.
And the same situation with the refugees. The horrible truth is that you know, people in Europe who protest against what is going on with the migration, they are presented as fascists or ultra-right by the European media. Some of them may be ultra-right, but the majority are just protesting the consequences of the EU's policy in the Middle East. If I don't like, for example, the French policy in the Middle East, if I don't like the French attempts to topple President Assad, which basically led to a lot of refugees coming from Syria to France, simply because Syria used to be a French colony, so France would be the first country where Syrians would go if they find themselves in Europe. So if I am a French person and I dislike this policy, does it mean that I am Islamophobic? That I hate Arabs, that I hate Muslims? Absolutely not. But that's the image which the European media, which the European mainstream media tries to create. It's almost as absurd as the American media creating out of Trump something like a Russian agent with deep ties to the Kremlin and all the other absurdities which would make even Joseph Stalin blush. Because Stalin, even he did not go as far as saying that any kind of contacts with foreign ambassadors were a crime, or that basically it was possible in the presence of members of the White House staff to pass some closely guarded secrets to the Russian foreign minister.
Or for somebody to bug the Kremlin. This is what they were accusing a photographer of possibly doing. You know, you talk about ideology, the role ideology plays in this, and it's an interesting inversion of the narrative, at least, and some of it fact-based, most likely, that ideology, you know, the primacy of ideology was one of the central flaws of the Soviet system. When you have a condition like you just described, where the solution to the economic problems of the weak links in the EU was presented, and the ideology, essentially the ideology of hegemony, that, look, the world is ours, go away, we want nothing to do with you, and we don't care what happens to Italy, Greece, Portugal, or anyone else. And with that ideology, though, comes an ignoring, basically, the material, which is, now Greece's economy is worse off. Now the tensions between Greece and Turkey, or whomever, Greece and Berlin, are going to intensify. The very structures that they're looking to use to dominate the world are weakened by their marriage to ideology as opposed to the material. And that kind of resembles what, you know, they accused the Soviet system of, that they said led to its demise.
Absolutely. And I think the interesting parallel here could be drawn with Saudi Arabia. One of the Soviet Union's mistakes was over-reliance on arms supplies to the allied countries. I mean, in Africa, the Soviet Union did more in the military sphere, you know, arming the independence of Algeria, in South Africa, you know, there was more of this than there was economic aid. And Ethiopia, of course, provided a very bad example of a leftist experiment in Africa. But look at what Mr. Trump was doing in Saudi Arabia.
Right.
Clinching the arms deals to the tune of $350 billion right. when the Saudi aviation was basically bombing Yemen, destroying an ancient and very interesting country, in many ways more cultured than Saudi Arabia. That was absolutely terrible. And what we see now on the border with the Soviet Union, look, during this NATO summit, there were two major military exercises taking place right on the border with Russia. Right. One in Estonia, which is, you know, like next door to St. Petersburg, right. formerly known as Leningrad. You know, the German army in 1941 did not take Leningrad simply because the horrible Stalin occupied Estonia 2 years before, and the advancing German troops lost most of their capable units in the fights on the Estonian territory. Right. So basically there was this exercise in Estonia, and there was another one in Scandinavia, in Norway and Finland, called Arctic Challenge Exercise 2017. So in that Arctic Challenge, there were 100 military planes involved from NATO countries and also from Finland, Sweden, and Switzerland.
Whoa.
And what did they do? They imitated the destruction of Russian anti-aircraft system. So that's the kind of defensive exercises that they make. Wow. And in Estonia, coming back to that first exercise, there were 800 Brits, 400 French, and several hundred of Georgians and Ukrainians involved.
Mm.
So obviously, when you have this kind of activity on the borders with Russia, Russians get nervous. And all of that is based solely, just like the so-called investigation against Trump's connection to Russia, that is all based on completely faked information, on completely trumped-up charges, like the New York Times, when they reported on Obama's meeting with the presidents of Nordic countries, again, Norway, Sweden, Finland, Iceland, Denmark, when they reported on it last year, they said that Russian aggression in the Baltics made this meeting necessary. So they cited this presumed future Russian aggression as a fait accompli, as something that has already happened. So in this situation, it is a situation when media reality can suddenly become a physical reality, very dangerous and very bloody. That was the case, for example, in Libya. Let's remember how it all happened. You know, when Colonel Gaddafi's forces were initially successful, the Western media started speculating about possible crackdown on dissent, you know, destruction of their position in Libya. That never happened. But what happened was persecution and destruction of whole, persecution of Gaddafi's supporters and suspected supporters, and destruction of whole cities on the Libyan territory. That destruction was made not by Mr. Gaddafi, but by the opposition forces, whom the Western media presumably saved from Gaddafi's onslaught.
Yep. That's the history of it. Art Dmitri, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.